Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway, Friday, August 4th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. For years, workers at the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi have asked for a straight vote to unionize. Today, they get their chance with eyes across the country on the outcome. Here's Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez.
A vote to unionize would be a major step forward for families in Canton, and it would send a powerful message to workers, companies, and lawmakers across the country that every worker deserves a seat at the table.
Bernie Sanders is in on the fight. Here he is at a rally in March.
The eyes of the country and the eyes of the world are on you. You can begin that revolution here that says that workers in America are entitled to justice, decent wages, decent benefits.
Activist Danny Glover has been there, too. He said it's more than just Mississippi at stake in a union vote when he was on our show back in March.
This affects not only Nissan workers. This may be the epic center for the new civil rights issue within the 21st century workers.
In general, unions perform dismally in the South, and today's result in Mississippi could be a signal about whether the South is ready to unionize and the power of unions across America in 2017. R.L. Nave is news editor at Mississippi Today, and he's here to break this down.
Like any other election, like most political campaigns, it's been pretty hard fought by both sides. I mean, both sides are running TV ads pretty consistently. People are getting into it on Facebook. Both sides are advertising on the internet. My coworker informs me that even his Yahtzee app, he's seeing ads for Nissan in the UAW. And so it's pretty exciting. I mean, I think, you know, we had a governor's election in 2015 where one of the nominees was a truck driver nobody had heard of. You know, the intensity of this campaign is probably more than even that was in 2015.
So describe some of the arguments. Let's talk about management first. What is Nissan saying about what it would mean to bring a union in and why workers should keep them out?
So their messaging is that if the union comes in, it will hurt Nissan's competitiveness. There are a lot of other auto plants, particularly in the South, that Nissan is competing with. The Toyota Camry, for example, competes with the Nissan Altima that's made at a non-union plant in Kentucky. And so if they are stuck in a contract with the UAW, they're saying that, you know, they're not going to be able to sell as many cars as perhaps their competitors. Maybe they won't be able to guarantee jobs in the event of a strike. Maybe they won't be able to have as many people working at the plant. Right now, there are 6,500 people who work out there who both work for Nissan and who are temporary workers. And, you know, the thinking is if the union comes in, they may not be able to guarantee as many jobs as they have out there now.
And how critical are the jobs at the Nissan plant to this community?
Well, it's Mississippi, so we're the poorest state in the nation, and we're talking about 6,500 jobs. I think Nissan says that they have somebody working at the plant from every county in Mississippi. So you take 6,500 jobs out of the workforce, you know, it has a pretty big impact. And we're already a state that has pretty low employment. We have one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation as well.
What's it been like? What are your reporters telling you about relationships between people in Canton, in towns around there? As this fight goes on, you know, in the restaurants, in the parking lots, maybe at church, everybody's involved in this.
Well, if you talk to workers, almost to a person, what most of them will say is that Nissan is an okay place to work. It's a pretty good place to work. It's a pretty good job to have. There is a feeling, I think, amongst a lot of workers who are supporting the union that wages could be a little bit better, benefits could be a little bit better, there could be a little bit more security, there could be a little bit more empathy from plant management when it comes to workplace health and safety. You know, one of the things you hear quite a bit is that the mandate from management is to run the line, always keep the line running at all costs. Nissan, you know, disputes that. But one of the things that the workers say is that just the speed of the line itself leads to a lot of, you know, sort of ergonomic injuries, a lot of cuts and that kind of thing, and that there's not a lot of sympathy from plant management when it comes to improving those conditions to make it more safe.
We need a union because workers are getting injured at an alarming rate. We're having workers to actually to die.
That's Morris Mock. He's worked at Nissan for 14 years.
My job, I'm a paint technician. I do major metal work, like major body repair. The UAW has actually been on the ground since, I would say, 2003. And, you know, we've been fighting. We've had our ups and our downs. And, you know, we've been just trying to educate workers on the importance of unions because, honestly, here in Mississippi, it's kind of new. And, you know, just workers having a voice and not being suppressed in their workplace.
So how has the union and the issue and the vote been going down, you know, in the break room, on the line, in the parking lot? What have those conversations been like?
This is probably the largest anti-union campaign against a group of workers who are trying to fight for equality and a voice. You know, there's private roundtable meetings, one-on-ones. You know, it's a vicious campaign. You know, you have managers and human resource reps wearing anti-union shirts and handing out anti-union literature. And anytime you have a manager or human resource that's supposed to be fair and impartial to protect the workers that have chose a side, and it's been an extremely aggressive campaign and a lot of threats, a lot of fear. There's a fearful campaign going on.
You say threats and fear. What do you mean?
Well, you know, you have through these one-on-ones, they imply that the factory is going to close in a lot of cases. In one-on-ones, they make direct threats that the factory will close. And you'd be surprised what a person would do just to feed their family. They will go through the hardest hardship. They will work with injuries. They would do a lot just to support their family and protect their jobs. And a company like Nissan feeds off that type of love that a person will have. And they will threaten you if you decide to choose a representation of a union. You know, if a pro-union worker places pro-union literature on the table, the manager immediately throws it in the trash. But we find ourselves with anti-union literature all on the break room tables. All we want is a fair election. That's the main thing. And Nissan's not allowing us to do that, even during the break room break time.
So, Morris Mock, you're pro-union. You have been for years. You're part of this campaign. What's your pitch to your friends and your coworkers when you're campaigning for the union there at the plant?
Well, you know, what we always say, we're pro-union and pro-Nissan. You know, we feel that every worker should have a voice, and without a voice, we feel, and I'm going to quote what the Japanese auto workers told us. They said that if we don't get a union, greed could destroy a company. And that's really the truth. You know, we even have Bible scriptures to back that up. But my pitch is just, you know, look, you know, we have to have a voice. We just want the company to listen to us. Nissan has been, you know, through the labor board and OSHA, they've been violated and they've been deemed as labor violators and also OSHA violators and repeat violators. So this is nothing that Mars actually has to pitch. This is something that's constantly going on every year. We've had over 550 workers to be injured this year so far. This is a thing that people shouldn't endure working in an auto factory.
So, Morris Mock, if you don't get a union, you okay to continue working at the Nissan plant?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm not going to stop until we get a union. I feel confident. I feel hopeful. And just praying that everything goes well.
And you're going to know tonight, right around midnight?
Yes, yes, we will.
Now, R.L. Nave, this is about the plant in Canton, Mississippi. There's no doubt about it, but it's about a whole lot more. I mean, this fight has garnered a lot of national attention. Danny Glover has come in. Bernie Sanders has come in. The Democratic National Committee has sounded off. This is national attention. So this fight that the UAW and Nissan are in are really about more than one car plant.
Exactly. I mean, if the UAW can get a foothold into a southern car plant, it will change the face of auto manufacturing across the country. And so far, the closest they got was the Volkswagen plant in 2014. And this election is probably one of the biggest, I think, in the South in recent memory. And so, you know, if you can get the union at Nissan in Canton, you can get it at Toyota in Blue Springs, and you can get it at VW, and you can get it at Mercedes-Benz in Alabama. You know, I know for a lot of people, you know, they're just trying to keep their jobs. You know, if it were not for Nissan, they may be working at McDonald's. They may be working at another kind of manufacturing facility, making a little bit less money. Maybe the benefits wouldn't be as great. And one of the things I've seen is that a lot of people are sort of trying to drown out a lot of the chatter that you hear from Nissan and UAW, trying to distance themselves from this idea that, you know, workers' rights or civil rights, and this is a huge sort of civil rights battle, and they're just saying, these are our jobs, it's our community, and trying to figure out what's the best way forward for, you know, their families and their communities.
R.L. Nave is news editor at Mississippi Today. R.L., thanks again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We reached out to Nissan. They declined to come on the show, but they did send us a statement. Nissan said allegations of intimidation made by the union are false. Nissan respects and values the Canton workforce, and our history reflects that we recognize the employees' right to decide for themselves whether or not to have third-party representation. You can read Nissan's full statement on our website at thetakeaway.org. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been looking back at 50 years since the Detroit riots. Many call it the Detroit Rebellion of 1967. We heard from a member of the Kerner Commission and a native Detroiter who was just a kid during the uprising. And today, audiences across America are going to get a chance to take another look at what happened during that week of violence between police and the community. Catherine Bigelow is the Oscar-winning director. You know her from films like Hurt Locker and Zero Dark Thirty. Bigelow's new film is Detroit, and it dives into one specific incident in the middle of the Detroit uprising. It took place at the Algiers Motel, where nine people were beaten by police and three black men were killed.
Well, the filmmakers have clearly seized on a powerful story. The 1967 rebellions in Detroit and dozens of other cities in America marked a turning point in U.S. history. And Catherine Bigelow has brought all of the power of Hollywood filmmaking to really give us a gripping first-person perspective on this story.
That's Scott Kurashige. He's professor at the University of Washington, Bothell, and author of The 50-Year Rebellion, How the U.S. Political Crisis Began in Detroit.
I'm not surprised that the film has had a polarized response. This is a film about a very polarizing time in U.S. history, and we are in another polarizing moment in U.S. history.
Later in the show, we'll bring you a roundtable discussion on what Detroit got right and what it got wrong. Stay with us.
The Takeaway is supported by Netflix, presenting The Incredible Jessica James, a new romantic comedy starring Jessica Williams and Chris O'Dowd, now streaming on Netflix.
There is more Russia news swirling around the White House. Special Counsel Robert Mueller has now convened a grand jury issuing subpoenas to get answers on the Russia investigation. Now, President Trump calls it a witch hunt and fake news. He'd much rather talk about manufacturing deals and the stock market. And why not?
Our stock market has reached an all-time high today.
Look at what's happening with the stock markets. Bigger, better, and stronger.
I don't think there's ever been a president elected who in this short period of time has done what we've done. All-time high. Think of it. Nobody ever talks about it. They don't talk about it.
Wall Street is booming. The post-election rally hasn't died. The Dow Jones Industrial Average hit 22,000 earlier this week, up almost 21% since November's presidential election. The president has tweeted about the stock market at least 10 times in the last month. Politically risky? Maybe. The stock market is soaring, and eventually it will come down. But for now, what's driving the boom, and what's in it for the American workers that President Trump counts on for support? Ben White is Politico's chief economics correspondent and author of the Morning Money column. He covers the nexus of Washington and Wall Street, and he says Trump doesn't deserve much of the credit for the robust stock market.
Part of it is the election. Immediately after Trump surprised everyone and won, you had a big move up in the stock market, partially because investors expect big corporate tax cuts, partially because they expect a lot of regulations to get shredded. Most of that is out of the stock market now. And what you see in the increase is really good corporate earnings, two quarters of double-digit gains in earnings, and an economy that's doing fine, 2.6% growth, decent job growth. So this is much less a Trump market now than it is a fundamentals market, because investors see that the White House hasn't been able to get a lot done. They don't expect huge things going forward.
We're going to talk about tax reform because that's the next huge project for Republicans on the Hill. But let's talk about deregulation, one of the small areas of success where Trump and Republicans have had a couple of wins. Is deregulation. Wall Street loves that.
They love that. They love it on in the energy sector, where Trump has been rolling back Obama-era environmental protections. And they love it in the banking sector, where they have seen some regulations reduced, and they expect more on the big banks. That's why you see the Goldman Sachs of the world, JP Morgan, Citigroup, all their shares have been doing incredibly well. It remains to be seen whether he's going to be able to follow through on some of these bank regulation changes. But for now, the market loves that. And there are certain sectors that have done very well based on the regulatory framework.
So how do people on Wall Street watch Washington, Ben White? You mentioned that a lot of these things are priced in. They're excited about deregulation. They're excited about getting their taxes cut. Makes sense. Dysfunction is rampant in Washington. Obamacare repeal, to the shock of many, Republicans couldn't get that done. They see a White House in chaos. And if I were an investor seeing those things, I'd say, yeah, I love getting my taxes cut, but they can't get it done.
Yeah. There's every time you see a big headline coming out of Washington on the Robert Mueller investigation or anything that's negative for Trump, you'll see a quick tick down in stocks. But that almost immediately turns into gains because, A, I don't think Wall Street is convinced that Trump's going anywhere anytime soon. And B, there's this belief that if somehow something happens to Trump, you'd get President Mike Pence, and he would be exactly the same as Trump on policy and a lot less chaotic. So there's not a great concern about some of the investigation stuff and a lot of the chaotic headlines. Wall Street will react in a knee-jerk fashion initially and then kind of ignore it because they don't expect it to amount to anything, and they're not too afraid of President Pence. And you know, it's not assumed anymore that they get tax reform done or anything done as long as they don't blow everything up with a debt limit scare or shutting down the government. Wall Street is kind of okay with that.
Let's talk about those big tax reform plans that Paul Ryan and the Republicans have. Obamacare repeal has failed for now. They don't want Strike 2. This is worth $1 trillion. And Paul Ryan has just invested an enormous amount of personal and political capital in this. It's really important to them.
If they fail on that, it's a very large embarrassment for House Republicans, Senate Republicans, Paul Ryan, and the White House. So you'll see a full court press from the administration, from Congress, and outside groups that are going to spend a lot of money to push this tax reform plan.
All right, let's take a step back from this for 1 second, though, the political moment, Ben White. We're hearing stories every day about stagnant wages, people who are having a terrible time finding good-paying jobs. There's a disconnect here, isn't there, in our politics? I mean, we're having this conversation about all of the cash pouring into Wall Street. They're going to get more. They're going to get tax cuts. And I thought that Donald Trump got elected because people were sick of this.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, there is a disconnect. And what the administration and Congress will try to do is make the case that if you allow companies to bring a lot of the cash they have stashed overseas back and you lower their tax burden compared with other countries, that they will invest more. They will grow more. They'll be able to pay people more. That's a bit of a hard case to make because on the surface, it looks like you're giving big tax cuts to fat cats in corporations. But really, they expect it to drive faster economic growth and then more jobs and higher wages. But I think if you cut corporate taxes, you also have to go after individual tax rates, particularly middle class tax rates. And that's where they're a bit stuck. They don't want to be tagged as cutting taxes for rich people only. They want to make the case that this will be good for workers and also individuals. So that's why they're looking at lowering middle-class tax rates.
Right. They're not going to call it trickle-down economics. I can bank on that for you.
I don't think they will brand it that way. No.
Are American workers going to buy it?
It's an open question. They'll buy it, I think, only if it actually works. They'll buy it if they see more job creation, higher wages, and a better standard of living for folks. They're not going to buy the rhetoric, but they will buy the reality if it actually happens.
you know, a huge part of Obamacare repeal that sort of flew under the radar was massive cuts to Medicaid, $700, $800 billion that Republicans were banking on. Is this entire project of tax cuts harder now that they didn't get that and that that effort failed?
It is harder. I mean, they expected the tax increases under Obamacare to be wiped out. That hasn't happened. So there'll be pressure from some Republicans to still go after those taxes. And if you do that, it makes balancing the books a little bit harder. House Republicans, particularly Paul Ryan, really want a deficit neutral tax reform. Doesn't increase the deficit so they can make it permanent. But if you're going after the Obamacare taxes plus cutting corporate taxes and individual taxes, that's a lot of money to make up and not blow a hole in the deficit.
Ben White, Politico's chief economic correspondent, author of Morning Money at Politico. Thanks, Ben.
Pleasure. Thank you.
August 5th, 2012, started off as a normal day for Pardeep Kalika.
Just your normal Sunday summer morning. We're headed to the temple. I'm taking my kids to Sunday school.
But on their way to the temple, all of a sudden, Pardeep had to turn around.
Fortunately, my daughter forgot a notebook at the house.
Fortunate. Because
it bought us enough time to not be inside the temple when the shooting actually occurred.
This is CNN Breaking News.
Welcome back to our coverage of a shooting in a temple just outside of Milwaukee early this morning.
Heavily armed officers gather outside the scene of a multiple shooting that took place inside and outside of Oak Creek's Sikh Temple of Wisconsin.
Police believe the suspect opened fire with a 9mm semi-automatic handgun.
Six people died that day when a gunman, Wade Page, opened fire on worshipers. Among the victims was Pardeep Kalika's father, Satwant Singh Kalika.
My father was the temple president. He is a first-generation immigrant. Came to this country in 1982, you know, for the same reason that most immigrants come here, is search for a better life for himself and his kids.
At a TED Talk in 2015, Pardeep described his final moments like this.
Before he pumped five shots into my father from close range, I wonder if he looked into his eyes. If he would have, he would have saw a man who exemplified the great ideals that this nation was built upon. Dedication, hard work, charity, service, and ultimately sacrifice. At the very least, he would have saw a grandfather who wanted nothing more than to make it home to see his grandson and give him one last piggyback ride. Even monsters understand the importance of piggyback rides.
In the 5 years since the shooting, Pardeep has done something surprising. He's teamed up with a former white supremacist named Arno Michaelis, and through their nonprofit, Serve to Unite, they've tried to prevent acts of violence from happening again.
I knew what the motivation was, and I knew that we were a first-generation immigrant, marginalized community who was new to the area. And I honestly believe that the courage came from ghosts and the ghosts of those six people that perished, saying, okay, you know what, you need to find out the why so you can do the what. And I don't think that we really understand the why until we know the human story, the human journey. And I sought out Arno and just asked him, you know, why did this happen?
Tell me what Arno Michaelis explained to you about Wade Page and what he thought was driving him that day.
Well, like Wade Page, Arno was also a recruiter. He was the leader of a hate group. And he really talked about the complexity of what happened to him and why he got in. It was a lot to do with not just the ideology, but the purpose of being something bigger than himself. I also thought about, you know, whether people like Arnold could really change, truly change. And he not only explained to me the reason why this happened, he pointed out to me how people and how we can transform pain. And, you know, oftentimes we say if pain not transformed is transferred or consumed. And, you know, really just that day as we sat down, we found out what we can do about it.
So you've gone on to found the organization Serve to Unite. You did it along with Arno. And I assume that a lot of the messages that you're telling me about, a lot of the ways that you guys have learned to interpret this type of violence and violent ideology is at the core of what you're doing with youth in Milwaukee.
I mean, me and Arno both approach it very much from the mental health lens. I am a trauma therapist in the area, and Arno also uses, you know, the trauma-informed lens to say, okay, you know what, What are our coping mechanisms? What tools do we have? What tools can we give? Not only youth, but we go out to different communities and work with policymakers, law enforcement, activists, people that are concerned about the changing demographic and the trauma of cultural preservation. Oftentimes, hate groups, now white supremacist hate groups, anti-government hate groups, take on the narrative of traditionally oppressed, sort of appropriating the oppressed narrative.
That fear and that trauma, some of it is familiar in terms of the type of prejudice that results, but Sikhs are now caught up in this sort of strange and jumbled form of prejudice, right? I mean, there was anti-Muslim sentiment at the core of what happened at the temple to your father and the others. But even then, that misses the mark because you're not Muslim. Not that it would be justified in any way if they were, but it's a complete mess in terms of the ideology at the core and then the outburst and the action that serves it.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. We're not Muslim, but our brothers are Muslim, our sisters are Muslim. You know, and we feel that as Sikhs, you know, a Sikh is interpreted to as a learner. Every moment is taken as a learning opportunity. With that said, Sikhs understand this to be, you know, apna kurbani, meaning that like it's a sacrifice. It's our sacrifice that will make us stronger. And this is not just a sacrifice for ourselves, but this is a sacrifice for others who may be targeted as well.
You wrote sometime after the incident that claimed your father's life, you said that forgiveness is the ultimate vengeance. There's nothing more vengeful you can do than forgive someone like Wade Page.
Yeah, and I hope that that lesson can be passed on. And this is the thing. You know, I don't want anything bad to happen to anybody. But the reality is that we probably know that something bad is around the corner. And whether it's a lone wolf shooter who is influenced by ideology on the web, or whether somebody who's recruited into an organized movement, we as people have the ability to transform that with forgiveness. And that's forgiveness with vengeance. You have to have a purpose. There's no forgetting about it. You know, people often equate forgiveness as forgetting. There is none of that. You can't forget about it. And in fact, if you forget about it, you really didn't forgive the way that you should have. And that's how you actually keep people safer. If Wade Page would have known that, hey, you know what, a friendship would have came out of this, where I befriend a former white supremacist and we can talk to 20 to 30,000 youth and we can go out to different communities and really just provide a roadmap of how we should move forward together. You know, if Wade Page would have known that, most likely he wouldn't have done what he set out to do. Because when a person is suffering isolated like a Wade Page, they don't want to create community. So with that said, forgiveness has to be vengeful, because now you know the next person is out there who's looking at the web and saying, well, you know what, if I can instill misery upon a population, I want to do that. The truth is you're not going to instill misery. You're going to bring a community together if communities can be forgiving.
Pardeep Kalika, I want to thank you for spending this time with me.
Thank you, Dad.
Pardeep Kalika is co-founder of the nonprofit Serve to Unite in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Hey, fellas. Melvin Desmukes. I'm with United Security. I'm guarding that grocery store across the street. I come bearing gifts.
Oh, thank you. I ain't got any sugar.
Nah, don't push it, man.
That's a scene there from director Catherine Bigelow's latest film called Detroit. The movie depicts a police raid in 1967 at the Algiers Motel, where three black men were killed and nine others were beaten by police. Detroit focuses on just one part of a week of violence in the middle of the Detroit uprisings of 1967. It's an intense and immersive experience, with Bigelow putting viewers right at that motel. And it's also a film that's polarized viewers. So we asked three people to join us with their reactions to the film Detroit. Dr. Scott Kurashige is author of The 50-Year Rebellion, How the U.S. Political Crisis Began in Detroit. Lisa Biggs is a playwright who recently wrote a play on the role of women who participated in and survived the uprising. And lastly, Cody Salfin, a former police civilian employee, currently a practicing criminal defense attorney. We begin with Lisa, who had mixed reviews for the film.
I was deeply, deeply disturbed by the lack of attention to the role of Black women in this film. Black women show up time and time again as nothing but wallpaper in this film, and to the point where they're mothers of the three men who were murdered by the police, Margaret Gill, Rebecca Pollard, and Violet Temple. They play no role in the film whatsoever. And we know that the women became some of the driving forces behind the subsequent investigations. You know, they were truly the lead plaintiffs in a civilian trial, a people's tribunal that emerged because of their determination to get the word out and to get a kind of justice, knowing full well that the, you know, Detroit Police Department would not actually protect their sons, would not protect them, and certainly would not investigate the officers and their brutality or hold them accountable. I fear that this film will not actually do very much to deepen a conversation about systemic racism and the problems that we have ongoing.
Scott Kurashige, your reaction.
To focus on the Detroit Rebellion as a police riot in which African Americans were systematically targeted is a provocative choice. Most of the people killed during the rebellion in Detroit were African American. Most of those were killed by law enforcement, and this was a pattern that the President's Commission found was nationwide. The other thing I think that's fascinating is to focus on police brutality, not as, you know, a police officer made a split-second decision and something went wrong, but to really focus on police brutality as organized white supremacist terror. For many in the Black community, the police were seen as an occupied armed force, and this is in many ways why people gravitated towards calling the events a rebellion rather than a riot. But I can also understand why these provocative choices have generated a really divided response. On the one hand, the filmmakers are talking about a story that's been basically kept hidden from the public for 50 years. And in many ways, that's true. But it also prompts the question of why has this been kept hidden for 50 years? It's also because, you know, as the Oscars So White campaign exposed, that Hollywood itself has a problem with institutionalized racism. So there's been a question raised as to why Hollywood didn't have more socially conscious and African-American filmmakers who could have told this story. And there are people questioning, do white filmmakers in this instance bring the proper care and sensitivity?
Cody Salfin, your reaction.
Yes, it's certainly not a film that you leave feeling good at the end of the day. At this juncture in time, stepping away from the film, it's critically important for the general public and the police to come together. And I fear that it does more harm in terms of creating and nurturing that divide, the us versus them mentality. But the police officers depicted in this film and the police officers in the 1960s, they did not have a lot of options in terms of use of force. And again, I do not defend the actions of the officers that were depicted in that film. But when they initially responded to the call for service, I believe that the National Guard relayed the shots fired call to the Detroit Police Department. And my understanding is that in reality, there was some sort of miscommunication from the police dispatch to the actual officers from the Detroit Police Department who responded to the scene. And when you're evaluating police use of force allegations or of misconduct, you have to put yourselves in the shoes of the officer, what was known to them at the time.
This is, I mean, my real concern about the movie is that it does depict that, you know, there was a starter pistol. And that alleged starter pistol was never found. The only people who actually mention it are the two young white women, Karen Malloy and Julie Heisel, who, as this film does depict, were, threatened, intimidated, and tortured alongside the men who were confined at the hotel. They are the only two people who ever said that there was a starter pistol. The film is really told from a very white masculinist police law and order perspective that leads to just a myriad of real dangerous presumptions.
Look, Kathryn Bigelow is an Oscar-winning director. Her involvement in this film guarantees it's going to be widely seen. A lot of people are going to see this movie for all of its benefits and all of its flaws. Each of you, in the end, is that a good thing?
In terms of the general public going and seeing this film, I think it's healthy for people to become aware of incidents like this. I fear that it will cause law enforcement to further withdraw from the community policing trend that has actually led us to more progressive police practices and procedures. I fear that the general public will withdraw from actually coming to the table in good faith and trying to find and zoom out and see that we're all humans instead of polarizing ourselves and looking at ourselves as white or black or police officers or non-police officers.
Professor Scott Kurashige, a lot of America is going to see this film from an Oscar-winning director. In the end, a good thing?
Well, the film demands a lot from its viewers. It's not uplifting in the way mainstream American movie audiences have come to expect. There's no hero that comes in and saves the day. And I understand why a number of, you know, African-American audience members in particular have said they don't need to see another film that exposes a reality that they're already aware of and potentially profits off of black death and suffering. On the other hand, for those that do go see it, you know, I hope it does draw attention to the broader issues that we're still dealing with 50 years later. The militarization of the police actually escalated after the rebellions in the 1960s. And, you know, I'm encouraged that so many police officers and police chiefs have come out and condemned President Trump's remarks promoting police abuse. But I think what this film shows us is what can happen if we return to a moment before we had any type of civilian oversight of the police and before, you know, we had the type of consent decrees and civil rights lawsuits that have been filed to at least put some check on police power. So again, I hope that for people who do see this film, they recognize that it's one story that needs to be put into a broader context. And hopefully, again, it creates this teachable moment that we're always looking for.
Lisa Biggs, you get the last word.
I think as Scott and Cody have said, that the film is an opportunity to reflect upon the past. And while it has limitations and flaws, it ought not be taken as the only way of telling this story. We are engaged in a fight for the future, a fight for the present. And the more we know, the more we know, so that we can make full and informed decisions about our lives today.
Well, I want to thank each of you for joining us to have that conversation with us and with all of our listeners. Lisa Biggs, Assistant Professor in Theater and Performance Studies at Michigan State University. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Professor Scott Kurashige at the University of Washington and author of The 50-Year Rebellion, How the U.S. Political Crisis Began in Detroit. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
And Cody Salfin, defense attorney. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
A new warning from the NAACP is gaining attention in Missouri. This week, the Civil Rights Organization issued its first statewide travel advisory, urging African Americans to use extreme caution while traveling through Missouri for their own safety. The warning reminded some people of a time when African Americans would carry green books. Those were guides laying out for black folks places that would serve them and places that were safe while traveling in the country. Katrina Thompson Moore is Associate Professor in History and African American Studies at St. Louis University, and she explains.
It was a travel guide that helped you stay safe in a Jim Crow society. It is dangerous to stop at gas stations. Hotels won't accept you. You could be killed in some areas. And so this says, hey, you can stop here and have a good meal and be safe. And so this travel book throughout the Jim Crow era became sort of a staple in a lot of black homes of this is how we can travel and feel safe and really go to black businesses and support them.
This week, the NAACP issued their warning as a new state law goes into effect in Missouri, making it difficult for workers to sue employers for wrongful termination based on discrimination. The NAACP also cited several examples of violence against people of color. The NAACP says its advisory will stay in place until at least August 28th, the end of the summer. Katrina Thompson Moore says she was surprised by the advisory.
I am not a native of St. Louis, but it's interesting. I've lived in St. Louis since 2008. And when I heard the travel advisory, no, I did not feel unsafe. However, walking down the street as an African-American female in the United States is unsafe. So overall, it did not make me more fearful of living in this region. It did highlight that, yes, this area is dangerous for brown and black people. But give me a state that is not. And so it highlighted that there is a race problem in Missouri, but there's a race problem in the United States. And so I don't know if the NAACP is trying to start a trend here or they're really trying to find a new way to protest legislation that is biased.
And that part of it is interesting from the NAACP. I mean, this is an organization that's been struggling for relevance a little bit lately. We've heard that younger African Americans in the protest movement are not as interested in the NAACP as they once were. And you're thinking maybe this does have to do with some new relevance for the organization.
Well, it does have people talking. People are talking about the Missouri NAACP. People are referring to this being the first of its kind. So it is a form of its own sort of protest, social unrest of having people have a conversation. And now people are talking about Senate Bill 43. So it does bring out these civil rights violations in this particular region. And so it does have that effect, which is a good thing. People are talking about it, and people now know that this Senate bill has gone through. It will be effective by the end of August. But the problem is, I don't know if this is going to work and is it appealing to the younger generations. But they are trying. This may be a new tactic. This may be a new style of boycotting for the millennium. I'm really not sure what the plan is after this.
Professor Moore, we mentioned the Green Book that helped African-American families find safe places to stop while they were on the road in the Jim Crow era. Does this remind you of that at all?
It's different than that. I understand the comparison. I do. Because with the Green Book didn't warn where not to go. It said where you can go. With this travel advisory, it's saying where not to go. Now, it will be interesting if the NAACP does similar to the Green Book, which started in one state and then looked at the whole United States. And if the NAACP starts this ever overall national movement and say all of these states have civil rights violations, and warn people and really highlight and call out laws, call out various violations of people getting killed by police, by racial, anything that's taking place, racial and gender biases, and NAACP makes it a national movement, that would make it more of the Green Book, but in a very different way. And so the Green Book was something that was celebrated in the African-American community. I don't think we are celebrating the NAACP travel advisory.
Katrina Thompson-Moore is Associate Professor in History and African-American Studies at St. Louis University. Professor, thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Have you heard about this videotape that kills you when you watch it?
Look behind you.
Red Rum! Red Rum!
Oh, just some scary movie.
Michael?
Why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Here. Movie Friday is spooky today here on The Takeaway. I think we're talking horror films. That's my feeling. Rafer Guzman from Newsday, our film critic here on The Takeaway, is here with me. Hey, Rafer.
Hello, Todd.
It sounds like we got a little bit of fright in the movies. We're going to be talking Dark Tower, the new one from Stephen King. At least Stephen King wrote the novel that's behind
right.
the Gunslinger films. I've been excited for this one, so I'm glad you're here. Let's do start with some trivia, though. We got some Stephen King trivia today. Now, if you know the answer, save it. Hit me up on Twitter if you think you know it, at Todd Zwillick. We're going to save our answer for the end. We've got some audio trivia for you here, Rafer. Here is a character from a Stephen King movie. Listen.
Cotton candy and rides and all sorts of surprises down here. And balloons, too. All colors.
Do they float?
Oh, yes. They float.
Rafer, name that actor and name the Stephen King monster that he's playing there.
Ooh, okay.
Terrifying.
Yeah,
terrifying.
Oh, okay. All
think
right,
about
Tom.
It. We'll come back to it. Let's talk Gunslinger. Now, I have been excited for Dark Tower. This has Idris Elba. This has Matthew McConaughey. I loved this book as a kid. Let's listen to a clip.
These visions, as you call them.
What do you see?
I see a tower.
The man in black.
And the Gunslinger.
They're just dreams. They're not real, Jake.
Rafer, please tell me this movie's awesome.
Well, Todd,
no.
Now, you can see the look on my face already.
Yeah.
Now, okay, now this is interesting, though, because you're a fan of
yes.
these books. Okay, you know, one question I think is going to be, who is this film made for? Is it for a fan like you who has read all 4,200 pages of the 8-volume series? Do you really want to see all of that squeezed down into 95 minutes on
right.
screen? Or are you going to be a little frustrated by that? You know, imagine how many characters are being left out. if you're a viewer like me who thought the books were complete nonsense and you could just not get into them from, you know, two pages into it, I don't think this is going to do you any favors either. You might just have to part ways here. I think if you're willing to follow Stephen King down this rabbit hole, the gunslinger who's sort of related to King Arthur, whose pistols right. are maybe made out of the steel of Excalibur, right. who's living in an alternative dimension and trying to protect the universe from a guy named the Man in Black, who's trying to kill the Dark Tower. I'm sorry. I can't do it. I can't make heads or tails of it, and the film is not helping me. So I'm not sure fans or non-fans are gonna catch on to this film.
And I see what you mean. I mean, as a fan, I always come back to this, but Lord of the Rings, which was a 3.5-hour film, each of them, even there I thought they didn't get into the beauty of the novel. So this is probably going to just drive me absolutely nuts.
This very well may. I just found it sort of not that emotionally engaging, not that interesting, it didn't look that interesting to me. There just wasn't that much in this film for me, again, as a non-fan of the books.
Is there at least a good performance from, I mean, Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey? These two guys are such big draws.
Right, two great actors. I just don't think there's that much for Idris Elba to work with, though I will say Matthew McConaughey is pretty good as the Man in Black, this kind of snarky, snotty villain. He's definitely the kind of villain you can hate, and that was a little something I could grab onto in the film, but it's not enough to really pull me through the whole thing.
It reminds you a little bit of the walking dude from The Stand, maybe. Okay, well,
yes.
We could have had a broader Stephen King discussion. Here's your trivia, Rafer. Listen.
Oh, yes. They float.
Name that actor and name the character.
I'm stumped, Todd. I'm stumped.
Jay Robison on Twitter knows it. That was Tim Curry playing Pennywise the Clown from It.
From It, yes.
Which they got a re-release coming out.
Yes, that's right.
That's in their trailer. That one looks scary. That one I'm looking forward to.
That could wipe out the memory of the Dark Tower. Who knows?
We'll have you back for that one, Rafer Guzman. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. John Hockenberry is back next week. It'll be John's final week hosting The Takeaway, and he'll be sharing some of his favorite segments from his 10 years with you. And we want to hear from you. If you have a farewell message for John, send it our way. 8778-MY-TAKE is the number. We'll play your messages on the show next week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is The Takeaway.
RI, Public Radio International.